I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. If you've been to the Four Corners area of the American Southwest, chances are that you visited Chaco Canyon. It's one of the most remarkable archaeological sites in America. The people who lived there up until around 850 years ago created beautiful dwellings and an extremely sophisticated culture, and then they mysteriously disappeared. With me now is Brian Fagan, one of the world's leading archaeological writers and an authority on prehistory. He's the author of many books, including most recently Chaco Canyon, published by Oxford University Press. Professor Fagan, welcome to my show.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm well. Can you describe the landscape of Chaco Canyon?
It's really an extraordinary place. It's a gorge with the most beautiful cliffs in the middle of the vast San Juan Basin, which is a semi-arid landscape, and you drive across this, and suddenly you find yourself in this canyon, which used to be quite well watered by the standards of the area, and at sunset, for example, these cliffs turn a beautiful rosy pink. It's very unexpected and very spectacular. It's rather like Olduvai Gorge in the Serengeti Plains in East Africa, where the earliest humans were found. You just aren't expecting it, and suddenly it's all around you.
I said that it was in the Four Corners area. Is it in one specific state, or does it cover all four of those states?
It is in New Mexico. It's a bit south of the Four Corners, but if you say the Four Corners region, you're in the general area.
And it's a real canyon. You say, how deep and how wide is this canyon?
It's in places up to about a mile wide. Most of it's much less than that, maybe half a mile. And it extends for about 20 miles in one form or the other.
It's been a tourist attraction for many years. Are archaeologists still working there?
Yes. What happened was I was asked to write this book on Chaco Canyon, an account of Chaco for the general audience to synthesize the work that's been done at Chaco since the 1880s or 1890s. And there's been a big National Park Service project called the Chaco Synthesis Project, which is aiming to bring together at a technical level everything but everything we know about Chaco. And I was asked to write the book as a result of that. And during it, I estimated there are something like 60 archaeologists who are working on Chaco or on the Chaco area. So it's a lot of people, and it's under the direction of the Park Service.
So the things that the tourists see, the things that I've seen when I've been there, they are only a small part of what actually exists in the area?
Yes.
How come we can't see more of it then?
It's simply that most people are short of time, and obviously the Park Service logistically really only runs tours of the part which is easily accessible. It's a very, very sensitive area because of the arid landscape and so on, and a lot of these sites that you don't see are still unexcavated. You can do it. There are some outliers you can see, but really to do it, you need an expert who's worked there most of their lives, like Gwyn Vivian in Tucson, who was literally born there, to really show you the detail. But you can get a very good impression from the central area.
Well, most of the ruins in the area from this people are cliff dwellings in Mesa Verde and Canyon de Chelly and Keats Seal and Batatican and all the other places there. But Chaco is really not in a cliff. It's on level ground. Does that mean that it was built before the others?
It was. It was early. It appears that these things originated from, ultimately, houses built half into the ground, what they call pit houses. And then somehow around 900 AD, or a little earlier than that, they started building these above ground. And they built them back to back, as it were, and then built them in semicircles, partly, I suspect, because of insulation, because you get cool in summer and warm in winter, because the climate there is quite extreme. And they built in Chaco above ground pueblos which stood free. They had outside walls and were freestanding structures, unlike cliff dwellings, which are often backed up against high rocks. They often built, Pueblo Bonito, for example, was built against or near to a backdrop of cliffs. They think the position may have been a sacred orientation, but they were freestanding buildings.
And how many stories high were they?
Up to three.
Well, that's extraordinary. And I've seen Pueblo Bonito. The masonry work seems very, very sophisticated. Is this something that the people of the area just came up with themselves?
They seem to have. It's actually simpler than it looks. And I don't mean this as a demeaning remark. Far from it. There is an archaeologist called Steve Lexon who's done a brilliant study of the architecture of Chaco. And he's shown that it evolved from basically very simple masonry walling into an elaborate, much more elaborate, where you had a rubble core through the wall, and the outsides were veneered with evenly trimmed blocks. And it happens that the rock around there can be trimmed quite easily into regular shapes, which made the job much easier. And it's clear that they built these walls very much faster than we would imagine.
How much do we know about these people? Can we figure out a lot just from looking at these buildings and the few shards that remain of their culture?
We know a great deal about them. A generation ago, they were called the Anasazi, but this is a rather pejorative name to Native Americans, so they're now called Ancestral Pueblo people.
Now, Anasazi was given to them by the Navajos, who came this land way after the Chacoan people abandoned these sites. So it must have been the same as when the Aztecs discovered Teotihuacan and wondered, what was this all about?
Yes, indeed. It's, of course, who owns Chaco is a subject of tremendous controversy between different Native American groups, the Navajo, the Hopi, and the Zuni. But we do actually know quite a bit about the Chaco people. There remain many unexplained things, largely because most of the excavation at Chaco was done 50 to 75 years ago, even more, when methods were much cruder than they are today. And the Park Service, quite rightly, has put a restriction on any digging in the central area of Chaco, and most of the work on the area is now being done on the outliers, outside the canyon, where Chaco had this influence. In the canyon itself, most of what we know comes from pottery and from artifacts like that, and some caches of ceremonial artifacts. We know quite a lot about what the people lived on, but there are numerous mysteries, among them the wooden beams and where they came from and things like that. What we do have at Chaco, and this is absolutely wonderful, is extremely accurate dating using tree rings from the beams in the Pueblo. And what they've been able to do is track throughout the Southwest the cycles of climate change relative to dates down to the year. At Chaco and elsewhere. So the chronology of the different parts of, say, Pueblo Bonito and when it was built are known literally down to the decade. It's wonderful. And that's one of the finest bits of archaeology in the world, having deciphered that. It's a magnificent piece of work.
My guest is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and one of the world's leading archaeological writers. His latest book, Chaco Canyon, Archaeologists Explore the Lies of an Ancient Society. It's published by Oxford University Press. You said that they started building pit houses, and then they built on level ground, and then they went into cliff dwellings.
Yep.
Now, why this progression?
Nobody really knows. It appears, and this is one of the big picture things here, is that you can't just look at Chaco as Chaco by itself. It's part of a much larger Pueblo world, much of which was in the north. And it seems that during a period of more increased rainfall, some of the people living in the north moved south of what would now be the area around Farmington, and came down into the San Juan Basin. And one of the places they came was Chaco. What they brought with them were various architectural traditions, among them the notion of building pueblos. And it's thought that some sort of influence from the north brought this in. Then, when the droughts at Chaco caused people to disperse and abandon the canyon, that many of them moved north. And it was there, during a period of increased political unrest, that many of them moved into canyons and developed cliff dwellings. But of course, it's a misnomer that everything was cliff dwellings. It wasn't. There were large pueblos well away from cliffs in areas like the Moctezuma Valley near Mesa Verde. And it's certainly not just cliff dwellings, although they are a feature of later Pueblo culture.
As some people would suggest, to keep them, to protect them from marauding bands of new arrivals like the Navajos and the Apaches.
That is one possible theory. The trouble with a lot of this, Leo, is that many of the most fascinating questions are what we would call intangible ones. We don't know what they think. We don't know the motives. All we have are the material remains of Pueblo behavior. And, of course, the problem with Chaco is you say, why did they build these huge pueblos where they did? The answer is we can only guess. We don't really know. We never will.
Their ceremonial sites are round pits. So would that suggest, I guess extrapolating, that was a kind of a tribute to their beginnings as people who lived in pit houses?
The only way we can really approach this is by understanding the Pueblo cosmos, which was a series of layers. There was an underworld, there was the living world, and then there was the world of the heavens. And Pueblo tradition had it that the first humans arrived in the world they lived in from a hole in the ground, which was the sipapu, or the root up, almost a tree they climbed up. And this ceremonial sipapu was in the center of the kivas, and the location of kivas was locating them in sacred places, and some of the most sacred kivas must have been in Chaco, because it's thought that Chaco was a axis mundi, as it were, an axis of the world, one of the very, very important ceremonial sites, because it was considered to be close to the very axis of the world.
Where everyone had originally come from. They have all these emerging symbols on the walls. So we know that. How much of that do we learn from the later Pueblo people, the people who followed the Zuni and the Hopi?
It's a very, very interesting question. That's a very difficult question to answer. The Pueblo Indians of today rightly regard Chaco as their property and part of their history. The problem is that Chaco was abandoned way back, almost 1,000 years ago, and oral histories really very rarely go back more than a few generations, maybe a century or more. And linking oral tradition with Chaco, as we know it as an archaeological site, is almost impossible. And in addition to that, we've got all these overlying different claims as to owns Chaco, quote-unquote, it being a national park, etc., etc. And it's very difficult to know if there are any reliable oral traditions. For example, one talks about a white house, as if this was the place Chaco was painted white or something, and it was a white house. What seems likely is that Chaco figured quite prominently in the oral traditions of all sorts of Pueblo groups, many of whom had kin relations there. Many peoples may have passed through there. And I think the only way you can look at it is as a very important, pivotal, ancient place in Pueblo history. But to identify it with the Eastern Pueblo or the Western Pueblo or anybody else is probably beyond us at this point.
My guest is Brian Fagan. His book, his latest one, is Chaco Canyon: Archaeologists Explore the Lives of an Ancient Society. It's published by Oxford University Press, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break here. Stay with us. We're back with Brian Fagan. His latest book, Chaco Canyon: Archaeologists Explore the Lives of an Ancient Society, from Oxford University Press. Mr. Fagan is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We're talking about Chaco Canyon as though everyone knows about it, but I'm willing to bet that the great majority of my listeners have no idea that this place exists. Is this something that is only known to people in the area? and to Europeans who visit these Anasazi sites in great numbers?
It's funny you should say this, Leo, because one of the difficulties with this book was finding a publisher. I'm very privileged that it went to Oxford University Press. The reason most publishers said no to it was that they thought it was a local book. In fact, Jacko isn't a local phenomenon at all. It's being called by very respectable archaeologists the Stonehenge of America.
And yet, as I said, so many people don't know about it. They may know a lot more about Mexican sites or sites in other parts of the United States.
Yes, and the intriguing thing is why. And Oxford, bless their hearts, decided to publish this because one reason they felt it should be better known. And what you've got here is a site which is truly spectacular. One of the problems with it is that it is a bit under the radar. You'll find that Mesa Verde generally is much better known, and many more people have been there. One of the reasons is that the road into Chaco for about 20 miles is not paved, and a lot of people are scared of unpaved roads. There's constant talk of paving the road. Only 20,000 people a year go to Chaco. If they paved the road, many more would. And on the one hand, while its remoteness is one of its attractions, one could say, but if they paved the road, many more people would go there. But it is remarkable how few people really know much about the Native American history of this country or its great sites like Cahokia, Chaco, and so on. It's rather weird phenomenon which nobody truly understands. This site is far more important than merely a local phenomenon.
What about during its time? Was there trade with other parts of the world? Were they in contact with the Aztecs or Aztec-influenced people from northern Mexico? Did they know of any people on the West Coast?
This is a fascinating question. There have been claims that the Chaco was the center of a great empire and there was trade all around the place with the Aztecs and so on. In reality, taking a very sober look at it, most of their trade in Tuquas, particularly, was local within New Mexico, copper possibly as far as Arizona, certainly some contact with northern Mexico, with sites like Casas Grandes down there, where they were breeding macaws with the bright tropical feathers. But any extensive trade to the south, although it was very fashionable as an idea about half a century ago, today is somewhat discounted. There was some limited knowledge and some limited contact, but I doubt if they were aware of the Aztecs.
Have any human remains been found?
Yes, they have found human remains in Pueblo Bonito and some of the other sites. Pueblo Bonito ones were found in the 1920s, elaborately decorated with beads, magnificently decorated clay vessels, turquoise, and so on. Clearly, these people were people of important social and presumably ritual status at Pueblo Bonito, but much more than that about them, we don't know. Now, the one area where they did do some trading into the southwest was with the West Coast in seashells, and it's clear that the Chaco people were aware of other societies. How far they directly had contact with them is a mystery.
Hasn't cannibalism become a rather controversial issue in recent years?
It has indeed. There's a brilliant biological anthropologist at Berkeley who did a study of a collection of bones from the Southwest and indicated by using conventional archaeological butchery analysis of bones that these bones of a human were undoubtedly butchered and cut up and presumably eaten. And there have been other claims by a man called Christy Turner, who's another biological anthropologist at the University of Arizona, to the effect that there was evidence of cannibalism at some sites. These sites are later than Chaco, and it's been argued that this is a reflection of a period of extreme stress caused by drought and so on, where people were fighting and eating each other. This, of course, cannibalism always raises a red flag, and people who study it and mention it are accused of being racists and so on and so forth. The evidence, biologically, is fairly strong that there was some, but it certainly was not widespread.
And there is a theory that the cannibals may very well have been marauding tribes from the south rather than the people of Chaco themselves.
Yes, and one must realize that these societies were small-scale societies. They were heavily riven with factionalism, a lot of rivals, a lot of quarreling. They weren't necessarily violent, but they were certainly volatile.
So you suggested earlier that this was a fertile place until everything dried up, and it remains rather dry and inhospitable now. Anybody have any idea of why those climate changes occurred?
If the word fertile has many, many connotations, you're not talking about the Nile Valley or somewhere like that. It was, for a while, better watered than the area around it. The San Juan Basin is very dry. And there was a wash, there still is, which goes through Chaco, and there was even at one point in the early days a shallow lake. And thanks to tree rings, they've been able to show the periods of higher rainfall, and one of them was when the great explosion of the Pueblos took place. And it's quite clear that then, as now, rainfall contrasted dramatically from one year to the next, and the drought cycles came in waves of 20, 30, 40 years. The brilliance of Pueblo agriculture was that they set themselves up conservatively and were able to make the most of the water from natural seeps and from the water courses in the canyon to support themselves.
What were they growing?
Maize and possibly beans.
Now, maize comes from the south. Was it a natural?
It's a tropical plant. In the southwest, it's about at the northern end of its distribution because of the winters and the frosts. The big question, of course, is, did they import grain as well? How many people lived in the canyon? Some people say as many as 5,000 at the height of its prosperity. Others say less. It certainly couldn't support enormous numbers of people, and it may be that the population of the canyon was higher at certain times of the year with ceremonial. The permanent population probably wasn't at the height of its prosperity, at the most 5,000, probably nearer 2 or 3.
My guest is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Among his books are The Rape of the Nile, The Adventure of Archaeology, The Great Journey, The Little Ice Age, and now Chaco Canyon, the book we're discussing. Archaeologists explore the lives of an ancient society. It is published by Oxford University Press. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. How much do we know about their agricultural practices?
Quite a bit by looking at modern agriculture. It's surprising how little, actually, American agricultural techniques are known, although this is getting better now. One of the techniques used was extremely careful use of natural seeps from the south side of the canyon, where water seeped out at the foot of the cliffs, and they would plant small gardens where the seeps dampened the soil. They would also create very simple but very effective irrigation off the wash in certain parts of the place. And, of course, they also cultivated very carefully during the rainy season and made maximal use of runoff and tried to plant and time their planting for the incidence of rain. But rain around there is very localized, highly variable. So agriculture, the secret of it was to have all sorts of different gardens and hope that one would feed you when another didn't.
And what would a typical meal for a Chacoan have been like?
A typical meal would have been based on maize or beans or squash. It would have been predominantly vegetarian, much of it ground into a sort of porridge. They would also eat wild plant foods, and if they could get it, deer, rabbits, and other game. Rabbits could be quite big business.
They were
important in the canyon. So it was a varied diet. Probably there were periods of malnutrition. Unfortunately, we don't have the data on it, but it cannot have been an easy life at all.
And I understand the bones also reveal a lot of arthritis and similar kinds of problems.
Oh, yes.
I wonder why everyone seems to wonder why they then just picked up and left. Drought is a good explanation, but they seem to have disappeared.
They didn't disappear at all. This is fascinating. You have a situation where climate change in the Chaco area, the whole of the southwest now, is extremely well known. And there's no question that El Niños, for example, events have serious short-term effects on the amount of rainfall there. But there was this huge drought cycle when Chaco was abandoned, which may be connected with the Little Ice Age. And there is a story about the ancestral Pueblo collapse, that the site was abandoned. Well, it was abandoned, but the society itself didn't collapse. If you look closely at Native American oral traditions of today, there is a very, very powerful tradition of movement. Movement in response to drought, movement in response to rainfall. And if you look at the history of Chaco from one end to the other, there's this constant movement in and out of the canyon. And what happened when the great drought came was that the people gradually dispersed. Where did they disperse to? This is the fascinating part of it. All these people had kin ties outside the canyon with other pueblos, other communities. And when it got tough, under the laws of, well, not laws, but custom of reciprocity, where if you were hungry and somebody else wasn't, they gave you grain, knowing that one day you would give it back, they moved out to settle with relatives elsewhere.
But what always has confounded me is that we have this very sophisticated society with very sophisticated architecture. Anyone who's been to Mesa Verde and to Chaco will notice just how sophisticated it is. And then they move into much less sophisticated places, and they don't bring their knowledge to them. What we see afterward seems to be a major step backward.
It was a step sidewards, actually, Leo. You've got some very large pueblos down in the Rio Grande and areas like that. But the tradition changed, the architectural tradition changed, living circumstances changed. The point about Chaco, which struck me very strongly when this whole project, was just how brilliantly adaptable these people were. They adapted constantly. And if they went to an area where there wasn't lots of stone and they had to build in clay, they built in clay. If they had came to a place with a lot of timber, they used wood. They were absolutely adaptable because they knew that the secret of survival was to adjust to very different conditions, changing all the time.
And so you say they just simply merged with the other Pueblo people.
Mm-hmm. Their descendants are Hopi and Zuni and whoever.
So why don't the Hopi and the Zuni have the final word on how to dispose of all of this? Why does this still remain a matter of controversy as to
because
who owns these places?
Because the Navajo moved in, I think it was in the 19th century, maybe a little earlier than that, and the Navajo claim it, and the Hopi and the Zuni say, well, this is our ancestral home, our ancestral center. And the truth of the matter is that this can never be resolved because each side is absolutely convinced and none of them will change their minds.
This goes before the Native American Graves and Reparations groups. NAGPRA is the act that deals with who owns what. Has anyone made any decisions?
I don't think this issue has arisen with Chaco that I know. I don't know about it. If they were, the question would be whom and who they would listen to, and that, I think, would come down to a committee of representatives of Native Americans. There is an advisory committee at Chaco. I think it would be their decision.
There's also some of these ruins, not in Chaco, but in other parts of the Southwest, turn up in private property. And there have been housing developments that have turned up all sorts of fascinating ruins. Do we run into just the standard problems that we have whenever someone owns some land and finds an important archaeological site on it?
Yeah. And if it's private property, effectively, you can do whatever you want. What's very interesting is that in the Southwest, the Native American nations now have formed their own archaeological units, and they work very closely, many of them, with archaeologists, the Navajo one, the Hopi another, the Zuni another, who and work very closely with archaeologists on sites on public land and on their own lands. They are determined to protect them. Private lands, much depends on the attitude of the owner.
I understand that many archaeologists in the Southwest now believe that we shouldn't excavate unless we have to. And if we do, to leave things for future generations to study.
That is absolutely correct. One of the points about archaeological sites, Leo, and Chak is a classic example, is that we love these things. We go and see them. In a way, we're loving them to death with our feet. And everyone says, we must conserve the past. Well, if you say that, you have to realize we're not conserving it for our children. We're conserving it for perpetuity. And one of the only strategies we have that is effective is not to dig it up. That's what the Park Service is doing, and they're absolutely correct.
And
however much we want to know more.
And then somewhere down the line, when will we know that it's the right time to start digging these things
up? I don't
up?
Think we ever will. I think any excavation that will be done if, for example, a cliff falls and they have to clear a piece of ruin, or when they want a particular question answered, they will issue a permit to dig a hole for a specific purpose. They might have to do some work stabilizing a wall. They will excavate around it very carefully before stabilizing it. It's all going to be driven by one word, conservation.
But when I visited some of these sites, what I've seen is a lot of broken pottery shards and dried up old corn husks.
Yep.
So they left these things. Why did they break their pottery when they left? And how similar is their pottery to the pottery we see today in the American Southwest?
The pottery is different, although it's obviously in the same tradition. The designs and shapes are different. And very often, the pottery you see broken is the stuff that was broken by them when they were using it. Sometimes they would ritually break pots and when they abandoned the site, and then they would go and make new ones when they got to a new pot. Place. A pot is a relatively easy thing to make, and they were disposable, like to us. A cheap plate is disposable.
Professor Fagan, thank you so much for talking with us today. Brian Fagan is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His latest book from Oxford University Press is Chaco Canyon, Chaco Canyon. Archaeologists explore the lives of an ancient society.